Welcome to the Stop Ruining My Childhood podcast.
A sometimes nostalgic, sometimes cynical look back at pop culture.
Join us as we revisit movies, cartoons, and live-action TV of the 80s and 90s and ask the question,
does this hold up or did I just ruin my childhood?
My name is Megan.
And I'm Steve.
And today we have a bonus.
Yes.
For Halloween.
We are talking about the 1980s vampire classic, The Lost Boys.
And why did we pick this to supplement our already recorded October spectacular episodes?
We already had Poltergeist and Gremlins in the bag, and then we were having just a discussion, and you said, I've never seen Lost Boys, and that was a travesty that we could not let stand.
Yeah, and then Steve said, I can't believe in your 46 years you've never seen Lost Boys. And then I had to remind him that I'm not 46, and I didn't like that. I didn't like being called 46 when I'm not.
You misheard me. I said in 36 years, which is how long The Lost Boys has been out. I can't believe you didn't see this.
Listen, I think that some people are making up what's happening and what conversations were had and what comments were made.
You are correct. Someone is making
No, I don't think so. It's not me, if that's your implication. So if you have been with us before, usually we do a cartoon, a live action TV, and a movie. We're a little out of order this month for Halloween. We're trying to do some additional stuff, basically. Yes. So as Steve mentioned, coming up, we have Poltergeist, which I think should air next week.
Yep.
And then on actual Halloween will be Gremlins, which features a special co-host that's not Steve, because he makes comments about people being a couple years older than they actually are.
That's right.
So we always do our snack review first, and then we talk about fun facts, and then we get into the movie. Like our memories, or lack thereof in this case, which we know that I have not seen it. And then the full review and recap, basically.
But first, my favorite segment of the podcast, the non-sponsored snack review.
Yes. And I'm trying, I don't know if I can. If I can't, I'll cut this out. We're going to have this new segment where we're going to play a vintage ad during our ad break, even though they're not sponsoring us. So, so Lemonheads are our snack for today.
Lemonheads. Apparently, because I'm assuming they're sour.
Yeah. And they're our snack for today because that's what we had in our cupboard.
Oh, I thought because they make you suck like a vampire.
Sure. Yeah. No, all right,
I'm going to try one of these while you talk about it.
Okay. So these, we've talked about the Era Candy Company before. They're based in Chicago. They do pan candy. They also make Red Hots, Boston Baked Beans. And the candy that I broke my tooth on last Easter for this podcast, Jordan Almonds.
We all make sacrifices.
And Jordan Almonds are kind of gross. So basically, this process is a spherical or oval pan. It's mounted on a spinning post. You put in, the pan is like open to the air to allow the ingredients to be added, the syrup to dry, and the centers are put in, and then stuff is added, and it rotates and spins. And as it spins and the air comes in, it hardens a little bit. So usually what you get is a chewy center and then a hardened shell. And eventually they stop adding stuff, keep spinning it, and it gets nice and shiny on the outside. I think this is a really interesting thing because the Ferrer Candy Company, in particular in Chicago, it's a really famous building. It's two stories and it's brick.
Okay.
And upstairs, they have these huge kettles. And there's a big wheel, like, churning all the kettles. And then the candy drops down a chute to the first floor where the packaging and stuff is.
Okay.
So it's kind of a neat way that they've...
Gravity.
Yeah, but... Well, it's kind of a neat way that they've set it up with the production on the second floor and then the thing on the
that
first
makes sense.
Floor. So they started out in around 1900. They had a bakery in 1908. And these were created in 1962. Now, this, Steve, is the part that gives me a little bit of pause, because the legend has it that back in, like, the 40s and 50s, and really up until the 80s, sometimes when babies are having trouble being born, they'll use forceps.
Yes.
They try not to anymore.
Right.
Right. Really, C-sections have been kind of improved and things like that. So the grandpa, who's the head of the company, takes a look at his grandson who needed forceps and goes, "That kid's head shaped like a lemon." And that's how they got the name for the candy.
Wow.
I feel like it's kind of damaging to a child, or it's a cute family story. I don't know, one way or the other. But they basically started making these first, and it's a lemon flavored candy with a sweeter coating, and then a kind of sour shell.
Okay.
They also have, and I have never had these, grape heads, cherry heads, apple heads.
Mm-mm.
They also have juicy heads, which probably have a juice center, like gushers.
Like a gusher, yeah.
And chewy heads. But blue raspberry heads, black raspberry heads, and love
heads.
Where
are all these heads getting made?
They basically had this candy flavors, and they wanted to like brand it all together.
Right.
But I've only seen lemon heads being sold.
Yeah.
But the blue and black raspberry and the love heads have all been discontinued. They also rebranded this in 2014 to lose the like little boy weird creepy image and have a better mascot.
Yeah, like the little mascot of like the person whose head was a lemon.
Like his grandson, yeah, apparently. And in the 1980s when we were growing up, the advertisements were kind of centered around sports with like kids almost like playing a game. I don't know if you remember that.
I do not.
My favorite fun fact, and then we can talk about the candy and I'll try some, is that lemon heads are sometimes recommended to pregnant women when they have nausea from morning sickness.
Really?
Yeah. And also people undergoing chemotherapy are sometimes advised to suck on lemon heads and other lemon candies because they help promote salivation. And then it makes them a little more hungry because a lot of times people going through chemo.
Interesting.
So they have some weird medicinal purposes. They're gluten free, they're fat free. And that means that I can try one.
So all right. Tell us what you try think. One. I don't think I've ever had lemon heads. I remember them from childhood, but I just don't think I ever had lemon heads.
Mm.
And so, not to my recollection, but I just had one. They are very lemony, and they are very sour. And Megan is making this face like I just jammed a full cut-up lemon in her mouth.
And then they're sweeter, though.
There's a little sweetness, but it's very sour and very, very lemony.
Okay, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like very bitter at first, like you're sucking a lemon.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like once you get past that, it's like lemonade, but in a candy form. I do like it, but I don't like the shell.
That's a good explanation, yeah. Yeah, so it's very, very sour, very lemony.
My memory of this is that I had these at a slumber party with my friend Christine before middle school when I had no friends, as we've learned.
Yes, we talked about that last week.
But we had a game, and when we would play like Truth or Dare, we had this game that we would play with lemon heads because we didn't really like them. So it was, can you eat them, like, without making a face?
Okay.
Which is kind of, you can see how, like, 9-10-year-olds would be a fun game, right?
You just lost.
I'm super lost. I really like the middle of these. The outer, it's not that it's sour, it's bitter.
Okay.
You know what it is? You know on baking shows where they tell the contestants not to use the fake lemon extract?
Yes, because that's too...
That's what it tastes like on the... Yeah, what it tastes like on the outside is like very bitter, like fake extract. But I like the middle part. So I'm going to go with... What are we rating out of vampires or bats for Lost Boys? Fangs. Okay. I'm going to give it 3 fangs out of 5.
Interesting.
It's okay. I would eat another one, but it takes a second to get used to it.
I am going
to
give it 4 fangs out of 5.
Okay.
Because it has a few things going for it.
That's a fast candy.
It's a fast candy. We know that I like fast snacks. I don't like to mess around. It's fruit flavored, which I like as well. And I do like sour, especially in candies. Matter of fact, 2 nights ago, I was eating a bag of sour Skittles.
Mm.
We all know, if those of you who listened to the Father's Day episode from a year ago, when my brother Kevin and I did Rad, we did Skittles. And you will all know that got 5. because 5 out of 5, because I'm a huge Skittles fan. So sour Skittles is also, it's not the original, but it's pretty good if you want some. It's almost like, it's like having Sour Patch Kids, but as Skittles, which is even better.
So these are kind of like sour Skittles.
So these remind me a little bit of that if I had like a box of all lemon sour Skittles.
I will say this, that because we played that game when I was younger, we've had this box of Lemon Heads for like a year.
Oh, yeah.
It's in our cupboard because I keep not wanting to do it.
Yeah, we probably should have done it a little early.
It got a little moisture in there. But, so I'm pleasantly surprised. I mean, for me, a 3 really isn't that. It's pretty high for this because I don't love sour things, but okay. I like the Melis. So.
Three and a half fangs.
3.5 fangs out of 5. That's pretty good.
That is a pretty good start, yeah.
So, Steve, you are a connoisseur of the Lost Boys.
I am.
So give us a little overview. Like, for somebody who's never seen it, what's the movie about?
So, in a nutshell, as we say, in the business, The Lost Boys is a story about a recently divorced mom who moves to this town of Santa Carla in California. It's a made-up town. It's actually Santa Cruz.
Right.
And it's on the coast. And she brings her 2 teenage boys with her. And they move in with her dad. Right? And so she's trying to kind of start a new life after her recent divorce. And bringing her 2 sons with her. And it's not a good move for them. They find the town to be a little boring. There's a sign on the way in that says Murder Capital of the World. And they're like, oh, that seems safe. Right. But she has an older son, Michael, who's probably 17, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And a younger son, Sam, who I'm guessing is probably 12 or 13.
Well, yeah.
We'll get into that.
Yeah.
And so as they're trying to kind of find their place in this town and things like that, both boys are trying to find interests and things that kind of grasp their attention. The older boy, Michael, ends up falling for a girl who ends up leading him into a bad group of boys.
Who turns out to be
vampires, who then his younger brother and other family members have to try to help save him from this group.
Yeah. So that's basically the movie.
That's The Lost Boys.
And in the midst of The Lost Boys, we see pictures of other lost boys and girls because there's kids who've gone missing because it's vampires.
100%.
So, yeah, I would say it's a little bit, it's not a horror comedy. No, it's more of like a horror movie with a little humor in it.
Yeah.
Like humorous moments. Yeah. I guess that's how I put it. Not like we're going to watch Gremlins in a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same as that. So
a lot of horror movies in the 80s and early 90s were kind of like that.
Yeah.
Even slasher films too. You know, it wasn't like today when you see things like, you know, Insidious, those kind of movies. There's not a lot of light humor in them.
Yeah.
They're very dark, But the horror of the 80s and 90s was a little bit lighter, but still kind of gory and scary.
Yeah, and I think I really appreciate that balance. And it's kind of, to me, not surprising when you hear about the history of this movie, because this was written by Janice Fisher and James Jeremias. They were first-time script writers.
Yes.
And the original script was a lot different, and we'll talk about some scenes that feel like they're weird and they kind of don't fit.
Yeah.
Because the kids were supposed to be like the age of the kids in the, like they were supposed to be younger.
Mm-hmm.
And it was inspired in those parts a little bit like by Goonies.
Yes.
And then the Frog brothers, who are the 2 kids who are like in the comic book shop,
mm-hmm.
they were supposed to be like 8 years old. So here they ended up going with teens because they brought Jeffrey Boehm on and he did the Weapon movies,
yep.
and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yep.
And you can see how those 2 movies also blend action with humor.
Yeah, right? And there was a switch in directors.
Yes.
And the first director wanted, was it Richard Donner?
I think so.
Wanted the younger Goonies idea. And then when Joel Schumacher came in and took control,
mm-hmm.
right? That's when they decided to age up and kind of go a little bit more serious.
Yeah, and he had read, Joel Schumacher apparently, before doing this movie, had read the book of Interview with the Vampire, okay, and was like, you know, what if you did have that idea that there's these vampires that are super old, but what if they're like Peter Pan? Peter Pan never grows up. Maybe that's because he's a vampire. And I think you can see some of that with like David, the head vampire, who's kind of leading this troop of lost boys. Yeah. There's one girl like Wendy would be, yep, you know, and stuff like that. Initially, it was an independent production company called Producers Sales Organization, but then Warner Brothers bought it. So then it got a little bit of infusion of money. And as you said, Joel Schumacher kind of wanted to like make it a little sexier, basically.
Yeah.
So he had Jason Patrick, who plays Michael, turned it down a few times, but then they told him he could have some creative input, and apparently he like helped to adapt the script. You might know Jason Patrick from his wonderful dramatic work in Speed 2 Cruise Control.
That is true. He was in Speed 2 Cruise Control.
We also have Diane Wiest as the mom. My favorite comment from Steve about this, what did you say about Diane Wiest, Steve?
I said, Diane Wiest is interesting because she always looks the same, and it can be 30 or 60. You don't know.
She had just won an Oscar for Hannah and Her Sisters, the Woody Allen movie.
Yes.
And I think this is an interesting project to pick after that movie. Like, when you get an Oscar, a lot of times you have a lot of choice. And this is what she chose, and it's interesting to me. Kiefer Sutherland and Corey Feldman had just done Stand By Me right before this.
Okay.
And we also have the guy, now I'm forgetting his name and I don't have it in my notes, but the guy from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, not Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, the Alex, guy who plays
Alex
Bill.
Winter.
Alex Winter
I'm
plays
so
Bill.
Sorry. Yep. Alex Winter plays, I put, it's either Bill or Ted, I'm not sure. That's what I have in my notes. Now, this was the first movie that both Corey Haim and Corey Feldman were in together. They were in 9 movies total. We're not going to talk about them in part because we already talked about them in Dream a Little Dream. So if you want to know more about their backstory, you can go and listen to that. And I will just say this, just to touch on it. We know that they both had very troubled history.
They did.
And a lot of trauma. But Corey Feldman was very clear when Joel Schumacher passed away at the age of 80. Corey Feldman said, he saw me on drugs one day on set. He came up to me and he basically had an intervention. He talked to me. He kept me away from that stuff. And basically because of the intervention, he was clean for like over a year.
He actually fired him.
Oh, he did? I didn't see that part.
Because he was high. And then Corey came back the next day and apologized. And he kind of took him under his wing and did an intervention.
And it, I know he went back and forth with it, but it's nice to know at least a couple of people were looking out for these kids, you know?
Yes.
So as Steve said, this is filmed in Santa Cruz. And Santa Cruz was like, you can film here, but you can't use our name because we're a family destination and we don't want people afraid of, like, not necessarily, the vampires are also filmed like they're a criminal element.
Right.
So they were like, you can film here, but only if you change the name.
And the funny thing about that is, they call it the murder capital of the world, which wasn't far off. Yikes. Santa Cruz had 3 killers who killed 28 people in the span of 30 months between 1970 and 73. So they really were the murder in the early 70s.
Steve, normally I'd tell you not to bring down the podcast. This is our Halloween episode, so I kind of feel like it's
but okay. I think it's hilarious, though, that, you know, 13 years later, they're like, we're a family place. We don't want you to ruin our name.
Yeah.
Like, you had 3 serial killers in, like, 3 years.
Oh, my goodness. I want to say a couple more things. First, Ben Stiller auditioned for this.
For what role?
For one of the, I think probably...
One of the vampires?
It's not clear. Either one of the Lost Boys or the Corey Haim role. Because he would have been about that age, I think.
Oh, he would have been young. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And he made a joke about it later. He was like, the last time I was in a room with this much talent, I was standing around auditioning with the 2 Coreys and Kiefer Sutherland. But Corey Feldman has an odd role in this as one of the Frog Brothers. His wardrobe is inspired by Chuck Norris, which makes so much sense. He's got like a bandana around his head and the t-shirt. A lot of the soundtrack is like an interesting mix of older stuff and contemporary stuff at the time in the 80s. It's got like In Excess But it also has The Doors and Elton John.
It has a lot of music
stuff. Yeah, and the background music is a lot of organ music because they wanted it to like feel like a vampire movie.
Uh-huh. The music piece you mentioned is interesting because Joel Schumacher's work with the music on this movie impressed Andrew Lloyd Webber, who then pulled him in for The Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because of this movie.
Yeah, that's interesting. A lot of the lighting is like red light, used kind of a lot. And there were a couple of shots that were done like Jaws. They did a lot of the aerial shots in part because they didn't have money to show people flying around. And then he decided to do these aerial shots of the vampires flying around Jaws, where in Jaws you don't always see the shark.
It's almost their shark's point of view, right?
Right. So yes. you see it from the vampire's point of view. So it's saving money, but it's also like building tension and anxiety for the audience. Kiefer Sutherland injured his wrist doing a wheelie on a motorcycle, and that's why he wears gloves in the movie to cover up the cast.
Yeah.
And they also had problems with the vampires have colored contacts, which weren't really a thing back then, and they had to be hard contacts, which didn't let oxygen in, and their eyes were always watering.
Yep. The scene where Kiefer Sutherland's hand gets burned in the sun.
Yeah.
He pulls it back, and then it shows him, and a tear comes down.
Yeah.
That wasn't scripted. It was his contact, but they left it. They're like, that looks cool, and they left it in because it was watering because of his contacts. Also, Kiefer Sutherland was not sure if he wanted the role.
That makes sense.
And then he heard that INXS's music was going to be in it, and he's like, that's one of my favorite bands, and that's why he took the role.
Well, I can understand that because the role that he has here is not too much different from Stand By Me.
Yeah.
And also, if you've seen Stand By Me, I think if you see that and this, Corey Feldman does have a pretty big range. It's that some of the choices here are weird.
And Kiefer Sutherland, while he has the most lines of all the vampires, he has the least amount of lines of the stars of the movie.
Yeah, and so that's interesting, too, because it kind of makes him a little more, like, when he talks, it's important.
Right.
There was going to be a companion movie, or kind of a sequel, called The Lost Girls. And I put my notes, but nobody cares about girls, so it was never made.
Well, there was two sequels.
There were, yeah.
Lost Boys the Tribe and Lost Boys the Thirst.
And those were in the 2000s, though, right? So they waited a while?
Yeah, yeah.
But were... And
Kiefer Sutherland's brother is the star of the second one, Lost Boys the Tribe.
Really?
Yeah.
But in a vampire role?
I don't know. I just know he was in it.
Was Corey Feldman in the other one? I feel like...
I don't think I've seen the two sequels.
And then they announced a new movie that was going to be in 2021, and I don't know that they really never like made it or anything.
Well, I think they announced it might be in production, but again, you know, with everything going on.
Between the pandemic and the writer's strike, who knows? Yeah. And then my last fun fact is we did Buffy the Vampire Slayer last year. And you can listen to that episode in our archives. But this influenced Joss Whedon's work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Remember, he did the movie and then the TV show more. Yep. He did the movie and it wasn't as dark as he wanted. Yep. But the mixture of mostly horror with a tiny bit of humor and having vampires who looked like people and could fool you and trick you.
It inspired him in a lot of ways because this was the first vampire story at all to ever use the term vamp out.
Okay.
When a vampire becomes like a vampire mode.
Yeah.
And that term's used a ton in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the series.
Yeah, I've never
realized. They use vamp out all the time, right? And so that came from this movie. Just one last thing. Jason Patrick did not want to do a vampire movie. He was really like, and he really just didn't want to do one. But Joel Schumacher got him on board by basically saying, hey, I'm going to give you a lot of creative control with your character.
Oh, interesting.
And so he said, okay. And then not only was he important in that, but Jamie Gertz almost didn't get the role.
Oh, now why was that?
Joel Schumacher wanted like a blonde.
Oh, okay.
And kind of waify blonde.
Yeah.
To play Star. And Jason Patrick was like, no, it's got to be Jamie. Jamie Gertz.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had just been in Solar Babies together.
Okay.
Another movie like the year before. and he knew her, and he's like, she's the person you want for this role.
She's really good. I don't want to get into it too much. She's really good in this. Do you know what I found out about Jamie Gertz was in Less Than Zero, and the 80s classic canceled too soon, Square Pegs, with Sarah Jessica Parker. She's in a number of things. Do you know she's worth $3 billion?
I did not know that.
Not million, billion.
I did not.
Her husband, she and her husband have been married since like 1990, so a while, mm-hmm. especially for Hollywood. And right around the time that they got married, he started an investment firm that did very well. And okay. and basically, she's been like part of that success, not just like he's doing it all, but like she's part of it.
Yeah.
And they own part of the Seahawks, or no, really? The Hawks, the
Atlanta Hawks,
the Atlanta Hawks,
yes.
and also the Milwaukee Brewers, the baseball team. So they have like
really diversified.
Yeah. And she's even said, and she's produced a number of things as yeah. well. So sometimes she's behind the
and
camera.
And she's kept acting. She's yeah. had bit pieces and things like that. 20 years later, she was reunited with Diane Wiest, and she did an episode of Life in Pieces.
Oh, yeah. Fun. Yeah, so it's just kind of interesting, like, how different people's careers, like, I like talking about a lot of this stuff that we do from the 80s and 90s, because you also see, like, how their career progressed or changed, yep. you know, over time. So and it's kind of interesting.
We had mentioned previously in Dream a Little Dream and things like that, two Coreys, mm-hmm. this was the first ever movie they were in together.
That kind of started, like, that whole, like, 80s and early 90s. Fanatical like
partnership
of yep. and like all the Teen Beat and Tiger Beat yep. magazines and all that kind of stuff. So with that, we're gonna take our break. Hopefully there'll be a vintage commercial here for you guys to listen to, mm-hmm. and when we come back, we'll talk about our memories or lack thereof, and we'll get into our full review and recap.
Michael and Sam have just moved to Santa Carla, California. They're about to discover its secret.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire.
Get yourself a good sharp stick. Drive it right to his heart.
You're a vampire, Michael. My own brother, a damn blood-sucking vampire.
Well, you wait till mom finds out, buddy.
When a vampire buys it, it's never a pretty sight.
Okay, we're back. My name's Megan.
And I'm Steve.
And my memory of this movie is that I didn't watch it as a kid. And I know that this is, again, one of those ones that ran on, like, TNT or TBS. And, like, I saw, like, I didn't even see full pieces of it. And I'll tell you why. The red light that they use a lot, just visually, I don't like it.
Okay.
And I would see... Like, I know that I've seen pieces of, like, their final battle or whatever, and I just looked at it, and I was like, that doesn't look like a movie I'd like. And there's, and also, now I will say, watching the full thing, I have a different feeling about it now.
Okay.
But not knowing too much about it, I'm not interested in a movie that's all guys and has really no parts for girls, or where girls are just, like, the sex object and the mom. That's not for me. Okay. In the same way that a lot of guys didn't like the women version of Ghostbusters because it's not for them, right. I kind of feel that way about movies like a lot of Adam Sandler movies. The woman is just like the object of affection that like she's there.
Right.
And she gets looked at and then they kiss at the end. Like, so that's basically why I never watched it. I just kind of thought it was like a boy movie and it's just in weird dark red light and people are dressed like punks and yeah. So, but you saw it as a kid.
I saw this in theaters.
Oh, you did?
So I was 10 years old.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I saw this in theaters. As I mentioned before, I'm a big horror fan, big slasher fan, even as a young kid. I mean, this is not a slasher film by any means. It's not as graphic nearly, right? As a lot of slasher films were. But I like vampire monster movies and things like that as well. Also, I'm a fan of Kiefer Sutherland.
Mm-hmm.
Especially young Kiefer Sutherland. Like, this movie, Young Guns, right? Which was a little bit after this, which was the story of Billy the Kid and his gang.
Mm-hmm.
Flatliners, right? There's a lot of stuff that he did in this time period that I like. You know, Lou Diamond Phillips as well was in Young Guns with him, right? there was a number of people at this time that were for a young boy, it's like, oh, that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
And it's good, and it's a vampire movie. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah. So I remember seeing this. I remember the Frog Brothers, a lot of this stuff. And I probably have not seen this movie in 25 years, maybe.
Yeah.
I've seen it probably a number of times, but not in the last 25 years. And so it's been a while, but there's still things that just popped out at me. You know, I remember the two Coreys being in it, the Frog Brothers. I remember basic plot line, things of that nature. Some things came back to me, to be honest, but it was, it is something that I remember from my childhood. And like I said, you can tell how much it had stood out in my childhood by how appalled I was that you had never seen it.
Well, yeah, and Tim and I talk about this too with Gremlins. We'd never seen Gremlins, neither one of us. Not the full movie.
What?
Yeah, not the full movie from start to finish. Because when it first came out, we would not have been really allowed to. By that, and then later, it just was like a...
What was it, 84?
84, and yeah. Tim was a year old when it came out, so obviously. But right. Even the sequel was 90, and he only would have been 7, and it just... PG-13 movie. Yeah, my parents would just not allow that. But with this, I mean, it's interesting because I will say this, I've seen little bits and pieces of Gremlins here and there.
Yeah.
I really, other than, like I said, a couple flashes on the screen, I really knew nothing about this movie, like not the plot or anything. So it was interesting coming into an older movie like this with just really fresh eyes.
So The Lost Boys was a surprise to you.
A little bit, yeah. The
Gremlins surprises me that you hadn't seen it. I know that you were young, but I would have been 7 when it came out, and I saw it as a little kid, and it was a big part of my childhood. I'm only saying this because I'm not on the Gremlins. Gremlins, but I had a Gizmo teddy bear that I slept with for a number of years as a child.
Yeah, so Tim and I talk, so we already recorded this, but it'll play later. Yeah. Tim and I talk about this, like, for me, it was really a lot of merchandising, and boys that were friends of mine and lived across the street from us, like, were super into it. But it just would not have been something that I was allowed to see. And then later it just seemed silly. And I just wasn't, like, when we go to watch horror movies, like on Halloween, mm-hmm. in high school with my friends, or even in college, that's not scary enough for like 17 year olds to pick 100%. To watch. So it just is one of those things that just kind of flashed by. And then I didn't have cable and stuff like that. So, you know, I would have had to like rent it on disc through Netflix and order it in the mail at that point.
And this is not one that's on a lot either, like you said.
So, right. Yeah. So let's get into it. We open and my notes I put, are we at a circus? Because I've never seen this.
Because the boardwalk that they have in the town, right?
But it's really cool. I really liked the setup to this, that this is a biker gang almost. Mm-hmm. They really show you, too, the difference between the punk subculture that's going on, right? Which was part of the
80s. 100%.
And also the families that are there. And also in kind of part of this, too, that the missing kids.
Yes.
So the missing kids are in the background of this movie, the other lost boys, as I'll call them.
Yes.
On milk cartons, on posters. And I have to say, too, you know, this is, now we have Amber Alerts, but this was a big part of our childhood.
There's a number of scenes in probably the first 15 or 20 minutes of the movie where in the background of the scene, there's missing posters of kids and adults.
Yeah.
Right? Victims and things that are on, like, bulletin boards as they're walking down the street, or on the inside of the comic book shop, or like you said, at the fair, or the boardwalk, or on the milk cartons, right? They're like little diamonds and pearls that are kind of dropped in to set the mood.
Yeah, and I really like that part of the atmosphere. I also kind of like that we're at the boardwalk, because it's this interesting mix of like games and lights and fun things, but there is always like the underside of the boardwalk, with like underneath the boardwalk sometimes there are people who are struggling with homelessness, or sometimes there's crime and drugs going on. Like, so above the boardwalk a lot of times are the families, and under the board Like, even in the 60s, there's that song, Under the Boardwalk, and it's about, like, making love under the boardwalk while everybody else is, like, playing games for teddy bears above it, right? So I kind of liked that. And it's a nice setup too, because then we flip over and we have the family coming in.
Yeah.
And I put in my notes, this is interesting cinematography. The family does not look like they will be ready for all this.
Yeah, 100%. The two boys are like kind of irritated that they're being brought. They're from Phoenix.
Right.
And that they're being brought out here to California to live with their grandpa. And they just, yeah, they don't seem to be really on board.
And let me tell you guys, first things first, it's not just like, oh, it's a nice suburb. Like, we're going to talk about in Poltergeist if it hasn't aired already. Like, oh, it's a nice, cute, beautiful suburb. No, no. This is like the show off grid.
Yeah.
Like, the grandpa is in what looks like a shack. There's a crumbling trailer outside, like not even a full trailer, like a camper.
Yep.
There's taxidermy stuff.
Yeah, he does taxidermy, and there's dead animals and stuff all over the place.
It's a very rustic cabin, and it's interesting to me, though, that it's kind of in contrast to, like, the very modern punk scene that we just saw down on the boardwalk,
right?
It's kind of, like, rustic and away from it all and everything like that. And then the grandpa is like, yeah, this is the murder, or they have a talk with the grandpa about how it's the murder capital of the world.
Yeah.
And the mom's moving in boxes, and she's like, oh, guys, you're silly. Like, what?
Well, they mentioned it to the grandpa, and the grandpa's like, well, there's some bad elements you have to be aware of. And then they're just like, well.
The guy who plays the grandpa is also in one of my favorite movies of all time, Doc Hollywood.
Yes, he plays the older doctor, right?
Yeah. And, so they're, so they've unfortunately moved to this place where she kind of has to move because the dad's gone and they need some help, but it's not the best circumstances.
Exactly.
And that is kind of clear right off the bat. So the first night there, we're back on the boardwalk. We flip really quickly between day and night in this movie.
Yes.
And they always show the day and then the night, the day and then the night, the day
and
the night. And
a guard tosses the Lost Boys off of a carousel because they're bothering people.
Yeah.
And he's like, I told you, get out of here. Hit the bricks. And they're like, okay, fine. And they take off. And then a little bit later that night.
Yeah.
He's going to his car and he gets attacked.
Yeah.
By what we can't see. Again, it's that, as you mentioned before, earlier, almost that Jaws point of view.
Yes.
Coming from the sky, though, which is interesting because Jaws is from under the water and this is from the sky, but both are, you know, things that you wouldn't expect necessarily.
Yeah, and it's cool because we get to see just the guard's reaction of like, what? But you don't see it. So it lets your imagination fill it in. And I feel like that's nice because nowadays they'd probably CGI the heck out of it and it wouldn't be as cool.
Right.
You know, it wouldn't be as scary. It's the same way, honestly, I think that in many ways, and we didn't have time to review it for you guys this year because it's like 3 hours long, but the ABC
the original miniseries
with Tim Curry, I think that it's scarier than the movies.
Yeah.
Because you don't see everything and it's much more about being eerie and creepy.
Yeah.
To me, that's a lot scarier than, like, the clown opening its mouth and it has jaws.
Because your imagination fills in blanks.
Yeah.
And it makes it scarier because you're not seeing.
So, we're on the boardwalk and the mom, she's looking for a job on the boardwalk because that's where the jobs are.
Yeah.
Jason Patrick, I think, is also looking. Michael is also looking for a job.
Yeah, he asks somebody and the guy's like, there's no jobs here.
Which is weird because there are obviously tons of jobs there.
The guy says, is there any jobs around here? And the guy says, nothing legal.
Yes, that's what he says. I put that in my notes too. Nothing legal. But she's kind of, it looks like to me, she's seeing the other moms who are putting up their lost children posters.
Yes.
But kind of also at the same time doesn't see them. And I think that that's an interesting thing in horror movies, especially ones that feature teenagers and kids. The parents are almost willfully ignorant. That they don't want to see the bad stuff that's happening, right, all around them, and that the kids kind of can. So then she sees a lost boy. She's trying to help him get back to his mom. And she meets her love interest, Max.
Max, yeah.
Played by Edward Herrmann, who you may know from the Gilmore Girls. But also, he played FDR in the movie Annie.
He did, yeah.
And I kept thinking, like, where do I know him from? And I looked his IMDb. And
I was thinking, oh, you know, this is a different role for him. Because when I see Edward Herrmann, I think of comedy, like more mm-hmm. comedy roles.
Yeah.
Or at least more like upbeat roles.
Well, he does a really good match for Diane Wiest because they both look like sitcom parents.
Yes.
What I mean by that is like they look a little bit comical, attractive, but not so attractive that like you would not imagine that they would be in a suburb right. or in Santa Clara or Santa Cruz or whatever. So Sam goes looking for comics and this is... Okay, this is my issue with this movie. We have Sam and the Frog Brothers, and then we have Jason Patrick, Michael. We have Michael, and the Vampire Group. And both of these are set up like, we're kind of going to be your friends, but we're also going to be kind of dickish.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think if they were going for a Goonies thing, like, establish that these kids are actually friends because the Frog Brothers are weirdos.
Yeah, their parents are always like passed out.
Yes, and they run the comic shop and he goes looking for some comics and they're like, hey, check out the civilian wardrobe. Now he's wearing, as Corey Haim often does, it's like weird clothes. It's like weird 80s loud clothes.
80s clothes.
It's
yeah.
like a loud sweatshirt with a big oversized suit jacket over the top.
Yeah.
And like board shorts. It's not like he went in wearing a suit.
But they're wearing camo, like they're in the army.
Yeah.
Right? And they're not, obviously. But the Frog Brothers, Edgar and Alan.
Yeah.
Obviously like yeah. referring to Poe, right?
But then they say the diet frozen yogurt bar is down the street.
Yeah. What? Like, you're probably not cool enough to be in a comic book store.
Yeah. And then he does this whole big thing like, hey guys, if I'm looking for Batman number 14, and they're like, there's only four of those in the world. He's like, five, but I'm always looking for the other four. So now you know he's cool.
Yeah. And then he actually fixes the way that they've got the comics sorted.
Yeah.
He's like, this Superman shouldn't be here because it's way before the other ones. And he starts moving them around. And then they know he's legit.
Man. Yeah. They give him a horror comic called Vampires Everywhere. And Corey Feldman goes, it could save your life. Now, the thing is that the Frog Brothers are both talking like they've deepened their voices on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And it limits their acting. Because it's just, again, it's like, that's a directorial choice. Like, yeah. Why are you doing that? Corey Feldman also is in Gremlins, like, a couple of years before this. Yeah. And right before this, he was in Stand By Me. And in both of those roles, he shows a lot more range than he does here.
Do you think it's a choice on purpose because the two brothers are trying to act older in everything they do?
Yeah.
Right? They dress like they're soldiers. And they're like 12, right? They talk about, oh yeah, like we're the ones to hunt vampires around here. And they've never really been in contact with a vampire,
yeah,
right?
I think
and so
it
they're
is.
Talking deep like they're older and tougher guys.
I think it is, but it also a couple times comes across very stilted. Because you can't get your full vocal range if you're like, hey, I'm going to talk like this the whole movie.
Yeah.
Like you can't fully do that. So it's a little weird to me. But what is really cool is then Jamie Gertz comes along and she's like, ooh la la.
Ooh la la is right.
Jamie Gertz is what we call a honey trap. And that means that they send a pretty girl out to try to trick somebody to come along and then they pull you into their cult. And then before you know it, you're stuck in the cult. And that's basically what happens
or
to Mike.
In this situation, a vampire group.
Right. I also kind of wondered, I have some notes here. Do you think that this kind of reflects, I know some of it's kind of like punk scene, but do you think it reflects a little bit like the satanic panic that was going on back then?
It's possible,
like,
yeah.
That our older boys are being pulled into
this.
Yeah, this
was about that time, yeah, where things like Dungeons and Dragons were being attacked because people were like, it's a Satan game, and there wasn't.
Kids listening to heavy metal.
Right.
They're gonna get it.
They're gonna be violent and things of that nature. Yep.
Then a couple is murdered. But here's what I find funny about this.
That's dark.
They're necking in a car.
Yep.
But while they're necking, she's reading a magazine.
Comic book.
Or because
they stole them from the comic shop.
That's earlier. Right.
Yep.
So it's like, well, yeah, we're making out, but also I need to find out what happens to Batman on page 4. Like, I don't know. I just found that kind of funny.
And then they rip off the top of the car.
Yeah.
And attack the couple.
Yeah.
But again, only from the point of view of the vampires.
And from somebody who's never seen this before, I really did like the buildup of tension that we have them getting kicked off the carousel. Then we see the guard being attacked, but not really because it fades to black. Mm-hmm. Then the couple's attacked. So it is a nice buildup of tension. And there's all the missing kid posters, again, kind of mm-hmm. adding to that. Then we have an unnecessary scene where basically he goes back and talks to the Frog Brothers again. This time he gets another comic, Destroy All Vampires. They say that they're fighting for truth, justice, the American way, like Superman.
Yeah.
You could have added that to the scene before. We don't really.
And they put their phone number on the back of this comic.
That's
and
right.
And go, you're going to need it someday to save your life.
Yeah. It could save your life.
Yeah. And you're like,
what?
Really? Now, actually, he does use that phone number later in the movie.
I know, but I really wanted at this point, this would have been a great place to have them just be kids and becoming friends and bonding, because they do help him out later, but there's no emotional heart to it. Like, have him hang out and help them hey, our parents are always passed out. Let's reorganize the store. You can read whatever you want. Even if they show them montage, reorganizing the store,
yeah.
Giving him some camo and eating all the candy.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all you would need. I just think that would help. But at any rate, they're really weird. Then without any money and poor as dirt, Mike buys a leather jacket.
Well, he goes to a concert.
Yeah.
And he takes Sam with him. And it's a concert at night on this huge stage at the boardwalk. And that's where he sees Star the first time.
He's seen her already last time. He saw her. He saw her in the other. Oh, no. He saw her get on the guy's bike.
Yes. The night but this before. Is when he really makes like.
She eye says, contact. My name is Star. And he's like, were your parents hippies? Which I find funny. And then in my notes, a lot of times I call her Moonchild because I forgot what her name was. I just remembered
it. So Moonchild was easier to remember than Star?
Which is from a totally different movie.
Yeah.
But I wonder, too, if this is like a Peter Pan reference, like second star to the right or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, she's dressed kind of like a traveler.
She kind of has sort of like a corset kind of thing.
Yeah, like the Romani, yeah. I guess you would call them. And she's got a corset, but she's got a long skirt that's layered, and she's got very curly hair that's all over.
It does also fit into, like, the punk heavy metal vibe, though, as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, but again, honey trap, stay away from that.
Okay.
Then we see the bikers, and they come up, and they're like, they don't like that he's talking to their girl. And I put one of them has a baby on the back because I just saw that it was a very small child.
Yeah, it's a child. It's a kid that's maybe like 7.
Yeah, maybe 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Then they kind of have a race. And I put here, the cinematography is really good. They're showing him on the bike racing against the other guys that are on bikes, and the way that it cuts back and forth between like wide shots. I don't love chase scenes, but this wasn't bad. It didn't take too long.
Yeah.
And then they go right up to the cliff.
They almost go over, and he stops at the last minute.
And I put, Mike and Kiefer Sutherland get into a fight because Kiefer Sutherland was about to push him into the ocean. And I can't tell if any of these people are really enemies or if they're trying to jump him into their gang.
That's almost what this is, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like an initiation. Like, they're seeing if he's tough enough, if he's cool enough, if maybe they'd want him to be in the the gang,
yeah,
because you don't really know they're vampires yet, right?
Then they say we're gonna eat Chinese food, but it's really worms and maggots.
Yeah, they bring them down to their lair, which is where the Chinese food is. Yeah.
In my notes, I called it the Bat Cave.
Yeah, and it's apparently they mentioned that it's a hotel. It was a resort that an earthquake hit and it collapsed inside, and so that's why there's like a chandelier. So it's like the lobby of this hotel that ended up being swallowed up by an earthquake.
Yeah, but other times they go into it and it's very clearly like just caves along the shore. I don't know,
because the really crazy part about this is a number of years after the movie, an earthquake did hit this town. And it destroyed the stage that the concert was on and the original comic book shop.
Oh, I feel bad. Because
those things were all left open, like for fans to come see.
Yeah.
And so it destroyed those things in an actual earthquake.
But at any rate, he's basically jumped into the gang and they give him stuff to drink. And she tells him that it's blood, but later he yells at her that it was blood the whole time.
Yeah, but he's like, no, it's wine, because it looks like wine. And, you know, it's interesting, though, because they sort of set him up on this. Because, right, it, like, Kiefer Sutherland hands him, David, Kiefer Sutherland's character, hands him, like, a pint of rice. He's like, want some rice? And he starts to eat it, and he's like, how do you like those maggots?
Yeah.
And he looks down and sees maggots, drops it, and then it's rice again, right? So he's, like, playing mind games. And then he does the same with noodles and worms. So for her to come and go, it's blood, don't drink it, it would be easy to go, yeah, you're messing with me, you just did this twice.
But also, again, so this is like a hole in this movie. And I will say, too, this movie is like an hour 40.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, I'm like, people could have cut 20, 30 minutes out of the film. This movie could have used about 10 to 15 more minutes of added scenes. Something that is actually compelling to make him want to join this group. Because he very clearly knows that he's kind of joining.
Star. Right?
Besides Star, if they had had something, even when we established the family, to show that he's like bitter about his parents' divorce, he wanted to go with his dad, he's mad at his mom, he doesn't like his little brother. Something like that to show that he could fall into a group that seems just like rebellious.
Megan.
I'm just saying.
Call Michael Winnie the Pooh, because the honey pot is all he needs.
Apparently. But my point is, my whole question as I was watching it is like, why would he be doing this? Like, why is he joining them? And he's falling to peer pressure, but to peers that he has no connection with.
Well, we do know also that both of them, both him and Sam, are looking for a place to fit in.
Yeah, I guess.
Because they're new here. They've been, you know, their whole life has been uprooted.
So he kind of is like tripping at this point after drinking the blood.
Yep.
They go to the bridge and they jump off and they're hanging from this bridge. There's a lot of mist so that he can't see. And he kind of is trying to pull himself up. Again, this is really filmed kind of neat because you find out they're flying.
Right? Yeah, it's a railroad bridge.
Yeah, it's a railroad bridge. Yep. And I put, he should never have bought that leather jacket. That just led to trouble.
That's true.
That made him attractive to the honey pot.
Yeah.
Or the honey trap.
She was like, ooh la la, this man wears a leather jacket.
He must be rebellious. He has longer hair. And we haven't talked about this too, but the biker gang is kind of like, they all look 80s punk. Kiefer Sutherland has like bleach blonde hair, kind of slick back, heavy metal kind of thing. A lot of them are wearing like what I call the Mr. T earring with like the feather in it.
Yeah.
They've got the leather on, the leather gloves with no fingertips, which is not good for thievery, but probably good for riding motorcycle.
Or hiding a broken wrist.
Or hiding a broken wrist, yeah. So he drops down, he finds out they can fly, and then do what I think is the oddest scene in the movie. What is Sam doing at home, Steve?
Sam's taking a bath, a bubble bath.
Right.
That his mom says, all right, time to take your bath. He's like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
Why do they have him taking a bubble bath? Like, is this part of the script that they just forgot to age up?
I don't know. And like, I think...
I know that this scene leads into Michael almost attacking him and the dogs defending him. But that same exact same scene could have played out with him behind a shower curtain.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. Now, I will say that there are two possible reasons. One, that they really wanted to play up the age difference and try to make him seem a lot younger. But look, Jason Patrick, by this point, very clearly in his 20s, playing a 17-year-old.
Yeah, he's playing a 17-year-old, but he looks old.
Corey Haim has a baby face. You don't really need to do this. The second possible reason is that maybe because it's such an old house, it doesn't have a shower, it just has a bath. But why all the bubbles? A 12-year-old boy is not going to do that.
You're telling me Jason Patrick's taking a bubble bath?
I mean, I would have taken one at that age, but I'm a girl and I like girly things. And I like, oh, I'm going to mix the vanilla one with the hazelnut today or like raspberry or whatever. But he's like, he's also playing in the bubbles.
Yeah, he's making like a bubble mohawk. And these are things, yes, granted, we see this in Ferris Bueller, right? But this is normally something a little kid does in the bathtub.
Yeah. Ferris Bueller does that in the shower.
Yeah.
Like a man. So at any rate, Nanook, which I find
kind Nanook of the North.
That's the Alaskan dog.
Yeah, he's a Siberian Husky.
Yeah, sorry, Siberian Husky. I put Alaskan Wolfhound, but no, you're right. He's a Siberian Husky. He basically rescues Sam because Michael was about to maybe attack him.
He was getting the bloodthirst.
He got the bloodthirst going. And then they go and he's like, Michael, look, your reflection. This is a super cool effect. He puts his hand up and Michael has half a reflection. Again, later on. He's almost
transparent a little bit.
Yeah, later on we find out he's not a full vampire.
Right, because he hasn't killed anybody.
Right.
And neither is Star.
And neither is the little kid either.
And neither is the little kid. Yeah.
So, Michael, Sam starts screaming, my own brother! Then he ruins his mother's date.
Yeah, my own brother's a blood-sucking vampire or something of that nature, right?
And he ruins the mother's date by calling her at the restaurant, which is, I love, it's such an old tech alert. You have to use the phone to call your mom at the restaurant because cell phones weren't a thing. So they bring the phone over to the table and they're like, ma'am, you have a phone call. And then we have... Michael is flying outside and convinces Sam to let him in. And I'm like, don't let him in, Sam! Because you can't fight a vampire, and everybody knows that. But he lets him in, and Michael is basically like, I'm your brother. I promise not to hurt you. I want to get better. I don't want to be like them.
Right.
Again, if we had had something in the beginning to establish that their relationship was under tension since the divorce, this would have been a lot more compelling storytelling.
Yes.
But I did like the moment between the brothers.
And then Michael goes out and sleeps with Star.
He goes to get help. And I put in my notes, he ends up banging Moonchild in the Batcave after like exchanging 10 words with her this whole film. And then they start flying, or the others are flying and watching. I don't know. I'm not sure what's going on here.
Megan, real love has its own language.
Stop.
It doesn't need a lot of words.
Again, it's just some things. This is why I feel like maybe this is why the movie, it's just losing a little bit of heart. And again, all you'd have to do is have one additional scene with the two of them where they actually talk. A 2 or 3 minute scene where she like maybe says like, you were right, my parents were hippies. They never really cared about
me. They sucked. There's something like that. Yeah,
and like, oh, they got divorced. Your parents got divorced too. And then they have ice cream together. Like, you know, during the day. I don't know, like something to show that they're falling in love.
At this point, Megan, do Star and Michael even know each other's last name?
No, and like Steve said too, there's not a lot of dialogue many times in this movie. So they have some hot eye contact. He goes to supposedly get help. They make out and then they start doing
it. And they're on a bed.
On a bed under a chandelier. I'm like, what the heck? And I will say this. The one thing I did like about this part is that you can't fully tell if she likes him or if she's doing that so he won't get help to like keep him in the group.
Right.
Right. And honestly, again, this is what happened in cults. It's been like the Manson cult, there was another cult that was doing what they called flirty fishing to get members. So I could see that happening, and I kind of did like that I really wasn't sure. Then we have Sam goes to get the other Corey and his friend,
the Frog Brothers.
And the Frog Brothers say, kill your brother. We've known about this issue for a while. Just stake him right through his heart. Yeah.
They go, we've known that there's some vampire problem here in town. We also think werewolves and zombies might have infiltrated the town hall.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, well, I was with you with the vampires, guys, but I'm starting to think, Steve, maybe you don't have your finger on the pulse here.
Steve, this is like you with your Monster Squad when you were a kid.
It is. It's a lot like that, actually.
If you haven't heard that story, go back to last year and listen to our Monster Squad episode.
That was around this time of year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did Scooby-Doo, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Monster Squad. Hocus Pocus. Yep. Those were last year's picks. So all those are in our archives. Max is next. Max is the mom's potential boyfriend. He's suspicious. There is one scene where a bat kite hits him in the head. And that's kind of cool because you're not sure what's going on. But now they think that he might... Listen, vampires require a daytime protector. A daywalker, if you will. But also, this is where they figure out they have a daytime protector. Michael hasn't killed yet. He's only a half vampire. They need to take out the head guy. So Max is coming over for dinner with the mom.
Yes.
You've known each other 3 days. You're introducing him to your kids. That's a parenting choice. Max says, I'll be a gentleman and let you invite me in. And I put my notes, no! Because you never do that. Listen, there are two rules that I have in life from fairy tales. Number one, don't invite anything in that you're suspicious of to your house, ever. You never let that cross your threshold. You don't invite it in. Number two, you don't eat with your enemies. That, Steve, is why I didn't eat lunch in high school. No, but really, not eating with your enemies is a huge thing in fairy tale. Somebody's going to poison you, for sure. So the Frog Brothers are coming to dinner to check things out. Now, this I liked because it is a little bit of humor within all this tension. They're splashing water on his pants.
Holy water.
Holy water. They're turning off the lights and putting a mirror up to his face.
They put garlic on his food.
To see if he likes it or not. And he's like, they're basically hazing me. I don't want to replace your dad. I just want to be your friend.
And he passes all the tests.
Yeah, he does. Then we see in my notes, I put teenage shenanigans and nighttime nonsense. Star is the biggest honey trap I've ever seen. Why are there no other girls? Is she like Wendy and Peter Pan? Is she a vampire? I don't know. I have so many questions. But Kiefer Sutherland, Michael is in a tree. He climbed a tree.
They climbed a tree.
Kiefer Sutherland finally reveals his full vampire face, fangs and red eyes and all. And it is very scary. Then there's this bonfire going on and it's really hard to tell who are the vampires and who are not. And I think that's part of the point, right?
It is.
And then the vampires attack the kids having a bonfire.
Yeah. They're also like punk hardcore rock kids, exactly. So they look similar. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the point, that they could be hiding anyway. So Michael is afraid and he doesn't want to be like them, but he's also tempted. So it's interesting because he's basically like, you can see him like trying to hold himself back.
Yes.
Right? But then he goes home instead. And Star, otherwise known as Moonchild,
she shows up at his house.
And she's like, can I come up? And he's like, no.
He's like, no, I'll be down to get you.
But the window's open, and that is enough.
And then she flies right up.
The window being open is enough to invite her in.
Yeah.
And so now we know she's a vampire, too.
Plus, Megan, she's like, you said no with your lips, but your heart mouth said yes.
Yeah, he talked to her with his heart mouth and his wiener.
If you're fucked up, you don't have to invite into the house anymore.
Two have become one flesh.
That's right.
So she says that she's like him, that he was supposed to be her first kill. David wanted her to kill him.
The night before, in bed.
Oh, I didn't get that.
Yeah, that's why none of them were around when he showed up and she was hooking up.
That's upsetting.
Yeah.
And Laddie, who is the younger kid whose face we've seen on the milk carton, he is also hasn't killed yet, but she's very weak and she doesn't want to become like one of them. And then we have what I called calling in the cavalry. they call the Frog Brothers and they take Grandpa's car and they go to the Bat Cave with stakes. Now, Sam doesn't want to kill, but they kill, and in my notes I put either Bill or Ted. I don't know which one he is.
Yeah, the Frog Brothers.
But Alex Winter.
The Frog Brothers, Sam and Michael come up with a plan because now Michael knows for sure they're all vampires.
Right.
So they come up with a plan that they know that during the day they're sleeping. So Michael brings the others to the cave, sunken back cave or whatever you call it, to kill them. They find Laddie and Star sleeping as well.
Right.
And Michael carries them both out to the car to save them.
Because the three of them can be in the light a little bit. They wear sunglasses and stuff.
And they're very sleepy.
They're very sleepy.
Michael falls asleep like three times during this adventure.
But at the same point, they're not burned by the light.
Right.
Right. So they kill Alex Winter's character. And then the vampires descend and David bares his teeth. And they attack.
They basically chase them out of the cave.
Yeah.
But then they can't go any further because the sun.
Right. The vampires get burned by the sun. Then he tries to tell his mom what's going on. And I put, she won't listen to him because she's too horny for the guy that she keeps trying to have
dates
with.
She really wants Max.
She really wants dates with. But they tell Grandpa that the Widow Johnson wants him to go over there too.
Yeah, Grandpa, there's a running gag that Grandpa keeps driving over to this widow's house to give her taxidermy. But he puts on aftershave and things like that. So you're like, all right, Grandpa's trying to...
to seduce the Widow Johnson. And then is my favorite part of the movie. There's a baptism going on. And the Frog Brothers run
in the middle of the church, in the middle of the baptism.
And they steal the...
They're filling up, taking all the holy water they can.
Like gas can tanks. And it's so funny to me. So they steal this holy water and they run out with it, and then basically we have this little montage. It's almost like Home Alone.
It's them preparing the house.
They
know, like, they get back to their grandpa's house. Michael brings Laddie and Star in, puts him in the bedroom, and then he falls asleep right there because it's still daytime.
Yes.
And I think it's Corey Feldman's character, Edgar of the Frog Brothers.
Okay.
And he says, well, we got to figure out what we're going to do in 2.5 hours. And Sam goes, why? What's 2.5 hours? And he goes, sundown. Yeah. They're coming for us.
Yeah.
So they basically are going through this, like you said, almost Home Alone, or almost like the A-Team. When they're prepping a plan?
Yeah, a little bit. So, like, they chop up garlic.
Yeah.
They make a lovely garlic soup with the holy water with the garlic in there. And then they make steaks. Basically, they're trying to burn some wood to make some steaks. And it's interesting because they use the two brothers to have more of the horror with the older brother and more of the comedy with the younger brother.
Yeah.
And that I thought was kind of interesting. So they attack. They shoot some holy water at some, they stake some others, and then is the big battle.
Well, there's only three of them left, the Lost Boys. Because there was four to begin with, and they killed one in the cave art.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the other three attack.
Well, they get rid of two, right? And then we have Laddie come in with Jamie Gertz, and she's like, I don't want to hurt him, and I put, but he's an abomination. You can't.
Yeah, because he's vamped out.
Now he's totally vamped out.
And she's protecting him still. It's interesting that you were like, I don't understand what she's supposed to be here. She is, as she mentions, a half vampire. We see her fly, things like that. But Jamie Gertz is the only vampire in the entire movie that never vamps out. She never has prosthetics or vampire face.
Yeah.
In the whole movie.
Because they want her to be hot.
Laddie does. Michael does. All the other vamps all vamp out. But she never does.
Because ladies are in control of their anger.
Oh, they is that
just,
true?
They just stuff it inside and turn it against themselves and have an eating disorder. But yeah, she, I also put, there's a lot of homoeroticism in this movie. And a lot of people have read it that way. I know you don't, but they get really close up in there to each
other.
This
is a tough movie. This is like Tombstone. This has got masculinity all over
it. Mm. So then we have the big battle between Michael and David.
Yes.
And everything's in red light, and there's taxidermy everywhere, and they're pushing each other, they're scratching each other. It's a pretty good battle.
Michael vamps out, and they're flying through the living room.
Yeah. And then he impales him on deer antlers.
Yeah, Michael impales David on some deer
antlers. Instead of exploding into dust, David has like a little baby face. Like all of the vampire stuff has disappeared.
It's just the sweet, innocent David that was under there.
He's just the sweet, innocent David. Not the murderer that, based on the number of posters we saw, has probably killed about 50 kids or so.
Not only has his fangs and all of his vampireness gone, but also his 5 o'clock shadow.
Yeah, I saw that too. So then Max comes in.
Yeah. So, well, they're like, you know, of course you think that it's over because they killed David.
Yeah, but Jamie Gertz.
But Michael is still vamped out.
Yep. Star, Michael, and Laddie are still vampires, and they are holding him back.
They're like, what's going on?
We haven't changed.
Yeah.
So Max comes in, and he says, oh, my boy's misbehaved. And he's Peter Pan, and he was hoping the mom would be his Wendy, because all boys need a mother.
Yeah.
And his boys and her boys could come together, to which Corey Feldman's character says, like some blood-sucking Brady Bunch, which is a perfect line because it's exactly what I was thinking.
Yep.
Your boys and mine. And then, who saves the day? Grandpa.
Grandpa. But Max, right before that, Max vamps out. So again, now every vampire except for Jamie Gertz is vamped out, right? And that's where I said before, I'm not used to seeing this actor in a horror.
Yeah, but
he
plays it really well because it's like the nice guy face is tricking you, yes. Right? That's the whole point, that it can be anybody. So he vamps out. He's going to attack them, but Grandpa saves the day and basically impales him on a big bunch of logs.
Yeah, it showed earlier. It's a setup. It showed earlier Grandpa was doing fencing.
Yeah.
And he comes barreling through the living room wall in his truck. And as he comes through, he hits the couch. And one of these wooden fence posts flies off the truck and goes right through the chest of the bad guy.
And he explodes into dust.
Big time.
And then everything's fine. And instead of getting a proper denouement, denouement, however you want to call it, resolution, Grandpa just says, the only thing I hate about Santa Clara is all these damn vampires. And then it fades to black and all the...
And that's it.
And the credits run. And I'm like, I go, that's it?
That's it.
It's very anticlimactic.
Okay.
So I kind of feel like I spoiled my review a little bit as we were talking. But before we get into our stuff, how did people feel about it at the time? What's the reception of
it? So this opened in July, so it was a summer blockbuster.
Why?
It cost about $5.2 million to make. It made over $32 million.
Okay.
It was a super success the box office.
Why do you think all of these like Halloween movies are always released in the summer and not near Halloween?
All I can think of is because the teens, maybe they thought summer was better.
I know, too, that movies at that point in time would be in theaters a few months, right? But even releasing it in September, I just don't understand why July. I mean,
it had an $8 million budget.
Okay.
And it made over $32 million. So it quadrupled its budget.
Okay.
So it was a success. It was the number two movie that weekend of its opening at the box office.
For an action movie, too, $8 million is not a bad budget for it to have.
Not at all.
Yeah. Nope.
Rotten Tomatoes, it holds a 77%.
Okay.
Based off 77 reviews, which is quite a bit, right? The site's critics' consensus talks about how it's flawed but eminently watchable.
Yeah.
Okay. The really one of the ones that was impressive, Roger Ebert, and I always like to talk about Siskel and Ebert if I can find them, because they were like, one time we should do an episode just on Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah, we should.
Because they were a big part of the 80s.
They were.
Roger Ebert gave the film 2.5 out of 4 stars.
Yes.
And he said he praised the cinematography.
Okay.
As well as he said that they had a cast that's good right down the line.
Yeah. I just want to say real quick, we've talked about Roger Ebert a lot. If you don't know who they are, Roger Ebert was the movie critic of one of the Chicago papers. Gene Siskel was a movie critic of the other Chicago paper, and both of them became very popular for having really intricate reviews that went just beyond summarizing the film.
Yes.
Which is what reviewers used to do. And they would actually kind of pull it apart and talk about it from, like, they talk about stuff that we talk about, cinematography, acting, all of that. And then they had a show together where they gave things thumbs up or thumbs down. So it was a really fun, like, I used to watch that show, actually.
Yeah.
And you'd get to see, like, oh, should I go to see it? And they could make a break or movie, basically.
The New York Times called Diane Weist's character a dopey mom.
Yeah.
And Bernard Hughes's character a caricature of a feisty old grandpa.
That's funny.
You know, but Siskel, you know, Roger Ebert, interestingly enough, said he actually did kind of like it. Like I said, he praised cinematography, he praised the cast, and he said that really the problem with it was a triumph of style over substance.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with some of him on there. I will say the dopiness of the mom and the grandpa, it's a teen movie at a time where teen movies were just starting to be a thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And most teen movies up to this point are like rom-coms, John Hughes types of movies, Can't Buy Me Love, 16 Candles. Right. So this is a teen movie that is kind of a little bit adventure, a little bit horror, a little bit humor. It's a different genre, I feel.
Yes.
And it's not just a teen slasher movie either. So it's interesting. But the parents aren't supposed to be important.
Right.
You know,
Variety magazine panned the film.
Oh.
And they said that it was a horrifically dreadful vampire teensploitation that daringly advances the theory that all those missing kids pictured on garbage bags and milk cartons are actually the victims of blood-sucking bikers.
Well, I mean, yeah. So did it win awards for
it? It won a Saturn Award for Best Horror Film of 1987.
All of anything we've watched, all of the sci-fi that we've watched has in some way won a Saturn Award.
And it had a lot of cultural. We mentioned it impacted Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which came back. And actually, you know, not only, like I said, in using Vamped Out, but the prosthetic and makeup of them as vampires here is very similar to how the vampires look in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
In the TV show.
Not the movie. Yep. And so there was a lot in there. There was some other, you know, one of the other things that we didn't really touch base on is, there was really intricate details in this movie that some people didn't get and some people did.
Mm.
Even the posters in this movie had reasons, right? In the Batcave, there was a poster of Jim Morrison.
Right.
From the Doors.
And they used his music.
And they used the song, People Are Strange.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a 1980s band poster in Sam's room. And that's a band that did a cover of People Are Strange.
Oh, okay.
Right. And then there's also a poster up that has Rob Lowe, and Joel Schumacher had just done a movie with Rob Lowe.
Oh, OK.
And so they all had these little, like, what we call Easter eggs now.
Yeah.
But back then, really, you know, a lot of people didn't put that kind of thought into the design of the set.
Yeah, I saw the thing of Guy from the Doors. I didn't put it together with the fact that they used the music until we had been talking about the music. So that's how the critics felt. How did we feel about it? Did it hold up to your memories? You haven't seen it in a long time.
I mean, the effects, it's tough because, you know, special effects have taken such a leap in the last 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's not a lot from that time that's going to hold up effects-wise,
okay,
because it's from 35 years ago. But I still like the story. I like the Frog Brothers. I like the two. I like Sam and Michael. You know, are there downsides to it? Yes. As I said, you know, there's some repetitiveness. Dialogue could use a little work sometimes. You know what the number one word said in this movie is?
Vampire.
Michael.
Oh.
And it's spoken 118 times in the movie.
Yeah.
But so it could use some work, but I still like it. It's to me, it's a classic vampire film. It's teenagers, it's their rock and roll punk motorcycles, the hot girl, right? Comic books. I mean, everything that I liked about the 80s is in this movie. And so, I mean, can I give it a 10? No. But I would say for me, it's a solid 7.
So, yeah, this is, I'm pretty close to you on this, actually. It's hard for me because I didn't see it as a kid. So I have to kind of think, like, would Megan at like 11, 12 have liked this movie? Because before that, I would not have been allowed to watch it. I probably could have watched it 11, 12, 13. I think it's like a PG-13 movie. It's got enough humor in there. It's scary, but it's not too scary. There's not, I actually appreciated the way that the filming was done in the Jaws style, and because there aren't a whole lot of special effects to be dated. The clothing is more dated to me than anything. It's very 80s, as you said. My issue with this is actually the opposite issue that I had with Poltergeist. And that is that with Poltergeist, they took too long setting up the family, the cul-de-sac that they're on, the little suburbia. Here, I'm not kidding you. I really think that 15 additional minutes, one scene with the younger kid, Sam, with the Frog Brothers, one scene with Star and Michael where they're not having sex.
Just laying foundation.
Laying foundation. A little bit more of the car ride to get there where you see maybe tension between the brothers or something that would indicate that Michael, beyond the, okay, they don't want to be in California, but beyond that, that something's going on where he's dealing with like the trauma of the divorce. It would not have taken that much to inject a little bit of heart into the movie. But I also put in my notes, Megan at 11 would have thought this movie was awesome.
You know, this is interesting.
I don't like the red light.
This is interesting from you because normally you think things are slow.
I didn't feel
it. You really think things can be sped up. To think that this could use time is a rarity from you.
It really is because about it, they cycled between the day and the night, the day and the night, the day and the night. Right? And they really needed to have more during the day so that when the stuff came out at night, it was worse and you cared about these characters more.
Yeah.
But like I said, I would have thought that this was awesome. Jason Patrick is a tall drink of water in this movie. I haven't really seen him in too much stuff.
You at 11 wouldn't have been into the Corys?
I was not into the Corys.
Okay.
Neither one of them. I had friends who were, but I thought that they were odd.
Okay.
Sorry. It was a pretty open thing even at that time that there were drugs involved, and that would not really
have... No, that would have flown.
I was super into, like, when the Tiger Beat... We were talking about, like, Tiger Beat magazines. Mm-hmm. Kirk Cameron.
Okay.
I have, like, a poster of, and we'll watch Growing Pains at some point.
Okay.
Because he's still very handsome. But at any rate, that, like, kind of more... I'm more into, like, the wholesome... Like, you. You're a good Boy Scout. I liked Lois and Clark that we talked about. Right. I liked Superman, right? But anyway, Jason Patrick is pretty cute. The boys in the movie are cute. Jamie Gertz, I would have wanted to look like, right? And they have some great action scenes, and it's great music, too, that is playing in the background.
So how many fangs?
I'm between a 7 and an 8, actually. I'm gonna go... it's hard because I never saw this as a kid, you know? So I'm trying to say, too... Like, if we had kids, would you show this to kids? Probably not. I mean, it wouldn't be in my top 10 for them.
If they were in their teens, I would let them watch
it. If they were going through a vampire phase. Because
there's nothing graphic in it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think I'll go with a 7 as well.
I mean, I'm going to be honest. If I had a teenage son, I'd rather him watch this than Twilight. If you want to watch Vampire Son, Lost Boys.
Yeah. I'll go with... I just said a 7, but I feel more like, I don't know, but I gave Superman an 8 and it's not up there. This is like a C+ for me, so I'll go with a 7.
Okay.
So.
Yeah! 7 out of 10 fangs.
7 out of 10 fangs for the movie and 3.5 for the snack.
Yeah.
Coming up. We talked about our Halloween stuff. We have Gremlins, we have Poltergeist, and then after that, we're going to watch Darkwing Duck, and then we have some fun Thanksgiving stuff, including, we don't have our What Is Steve Willing to Watch segment, but I'm going to give you guys a little hint. Steve Hall is finally willing to watch Friends. Oh. And they were known for their Thanksgiving episodes, and I'm super excited about it. So that's what we have coming up. Don't forget to like and subscribe.
And you know what? Check out our YouTube channel, because we have all of these podcast episodes on our YouTube channel. Stop Ruining My Childhood.
Yep.
Right? And I'm going to be adding some small reviews of recent things that reflect also my childhood. And so those will be video reviews. So you, if you ever been listening to this and said, I wonder what that handsome sounding tall drink of water looks like, you could watch me a little drop some reviews and information on current things that also touch on childhood
and have been ruined for you, most possibly. Especially,
you know, it's Stop Ruining My Childhood, but maybe just like here, we'll find some gems.
And you can follow us at Stop Ruining My Childhood on Instagram and www.stopruiningmychildhood.com, where you can find all the links to listen. All of our episodes are up. We have, at this point, I think about 60 or so episodes.
Yeah.
So a lot in our archives to catch up on if you're just visiting us. So that's it. Have a great Halloween, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.